And welcome to Peace and Social Justice. This is Sue Hildebrand. I'm sitting in for this edition. Today on Peace and Social Justice, we will first talk about an aspect of the social justice movement that has been neglected, but is key to success. Professor Robert Jones of Chico State University's Philosophy Department will talk about his work and his upcoming article entitled Animal Rights is a Social Justice Issue. We'll then be joined by Chico City Council Member Randall Stone to talk about the recently approved contract with the City Police Association, and we will talk about other city business. Thanks for tuning in today on Peace and Social Justice. We will be right back. That revolution starts right now. Today on Peace and Social Justice, we will first talk about an aspect of the social justice movement that has been neglected but is key to success. You're listening to Peace and Social Justice right now. So let's jump right in. When you think of social justice and the social justice movement, what is it you think of? I guess in some fundamental way, the idea of social justice could be described as the minimalization of violence, of exploitation, of domination, of objectification, and of oppression. And of course, the movement is the active effort to achieving this. And I think it's fair to say that we think of social justice as only applying to humans, to human animals. We don't tend to include non-human animals as recipients of social justice, of deserving social justice. However, in a soon-to-be-released academic paper called Animal Rights is a Social Justice Issue, Professor Robert Jones argues that to truly have social justice, we must expand our sphere to include non-human animals. Professor Jones teaches at Chico State University in the philosophy department. However, he is on the phone with us from Binghamton, New York. He's at the 2015 North America Institute for Critical Animal Studies Conference. Professor Jones will be giving a talk tomorrow entitled Strategies Against Animal Research and Ranching. I'm happy to welcome you to Peace and Social Justice, Professor Jones.
Hi, Sue. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so listen, let's jump right in. And if we're going to talk about the need to include non-human animals in our quest for social justice, we've got to first define that. Give us a working definition of social justice for this conversation.
Well, there's, you know, traditionally, classic political philosophers, people like John Rawls, when they speak of social justice, from the theoretical aspect, they're usually focusing on things like the distribution of goods, right? So when goods and bads, right? So we can say, for example, if there's a community that's underserved with regard to health care, or there's some kind of dumping of toxic chemicals in a community, we say that's a social justice issue. So that the distribution of goods and bads is the kind of notion that traditionally people talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But with regard to a kind of a more recent notion of social justice, we can think of social justice in terms of things like oppression, in terms of things like domination. And by domination, I mean something like institutional constraints on self-determination. Or by oppression, I'm thinking of institutional constraints on development and self-development. So social justice, rather than being focused solely on the distribution of goods and bads, can also include these notions of domination and oppression. And that's a key aspect of social justice. And I believe that most people who are in the social justice movement, whether or not they've explicitly thought about it, they are fighting domination and oppression, and usually in some kind of systemic way. So if we couch social justice in those terms, then once we open up the door to domination and oppression as being integral parts of social justice, then we can allow or more easily get in under the umbrella of social justice, mm-hmm. non-human animals.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's interesting when you said, you know, most people that think of social justice, they maybe you don't use those terms, but we are talking about oppression and domination, you know, and just to think about it in terms of racism and sexism, and as you point out, very briefly, heterosexism, and this idea of it is about domination and oppression, this idea of not allowing self-determination and actualization, those kinds of things. Professor Jones, in your paper, Animal Rights is a Social Justice Issue, you argue that people or humans think of humans as being exceptional, and you call it speciesism. So explain what that means.
Well, speciesism is a term that, I mean, I didn't coin the term. It's been around since the 70s, but it's a new term for a lot of people. And the term speciesism is a concept that came out of the 1970s during the civil rights movement, during the women's lib movement. So we had in the political air, we have the notions of anti-racism and anti-sexism, and from that is birthed this notion of speciesism. Now, when we think about something like racism, and we think, well, what is it that's immoral? What's wrong with racism? And it turns out that one of the key aspects of the wrongness of racism is that it picks out something that's not morally relevant. It picks out a property, a characteristics of human beings that really shouldn't play any role in how people are treated, right? So if I'm being explicitly racist, I'm picking out something in humans that really shouldn't play any role. Same thing with sexism. So keeping that line of reasoning, speciesism is a belief that members of one's own species are morally superior to beings of other species. So it's a superiority theory like racism and sexism, and it says that humans are at the top, and we've all heard of the phrase American exceptionalism. Well, mm-hmm. there is a kind of human exceptionalism that we just assume is true, and it says that human beings are at the top of the heap when it comes to ethical and moral treatment. And speciesism says, basically, when you ask someone the question, Sue, when I teach this in my class, I say, why is it that all and only human beings are the most important members of the moral community? The kind of answers I get are the same kinds of answers that people gave 100 years ago, 50 years ago, when they were asked, why are white people the most important? Why are men the most important? It's the same kind of reasoning. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's time that we acknowledge that human beings, although very special animals, we are animals, and we do have special properties, and we have speech and things like that, but that doesn't justify domination and oppression of sentient beings, especially at the massive systemic levels that we have it today.
Well, Professor, let me say, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Peace and Social Justice on KZFR Radio. We're talking with Professor Robert Jones, who is a professor in the philosophy department at Chico State University. Professor Jones, you know, I want to respond to exactly that and kind of move us along, but I do want to stop you there for one second, because I have this wonderful little dog, and if we're talking about, you know, non-human animals, and you talk about the morality is only applied to humans. I look at my dog, and I take a lot of life lessons from my dog. He's a part chow. He was feral when I got him. He's really a nutty. It's a very difficult breed, very stubborn. And my dog will randomly, he's fed very well, will randomly and go and kill something and then just sort of walk away. And so talk about that sort of attitude or that aspect, because I can hear the voices in my head saying, well, the reason we only apply morality to humans is because only humans have real morality. So talk about that.
Sure. That's a good question. So in the world of academic ethics, when you study this stuff and you read people like Peter Singer and animal rights people, there's an important distinction that we have to make, and that's the distinction between a moral agent and a non-moral agent. So, for example, you and I, we're moral agents, and that means that we are blameworthy and praiseworthy for our actions, right?
Okay.
But there are large numbers of both human and non-human animals who are not moral agents. For example, children. Children are not held morally blameworthy or praiseworthy for their actions.
Uh-huh.
There are humans who are congenitally cognitively disabled that we don't hold to the same kind of moral blameworthiness as we do for moral agents. Likewise, non-human animals we put in the category of moral patient, non-agent. Now, it's true that your dog cannot be held morally blameworthy and praiseworthy in the same way that an agent can be held blameworthy. But from the fact that you're not a moral agent, from the fact that you're not held morally blameworthy, it doesn't mean that you don't have moral status. And that makes perfect sense because, for example, our children, they do things that they're not blameworthy for, and yet they have full moral status. So the fact that your dog lacks this kind of agency that we usually associate with moral blameworthiness and praiseworthiness, the fact that your dog lacks that doesn't mean your dog is now kicked out of the club of things that are morally considerable. In fact, I would say that because your dog and because children and because the cognitively disabled are more vulnerable than agents, it can be argued that we have a greater moral responsibility to care for them than we do for agents.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Very interesting. Professor Jones, good. That cleared up a whole bunch of stuff for me. So in your article, animal rights is a social justice issue. Let's go back to speciesism a little bit. You wrote that speciesism is a core component of oppression, and as I've been sort of chewing through your argument, it seems that what you're saying is that it's the attitude that some life forms are more superior or inferior than others. And if my understanding is correct, I want to ask you to talk about that slippery slope where humans have treated other humans badly and justified it, as you were talking about earlier, justified it by viewing those particular humans, African Americans, women, and so on, viewing them as less than human. So talk about that perspective, like real concrete examples. For example, the slave trade.
Sure. So first, let me just say that when I speak about the history of oppression, I'm talking specifically about aspects like exploitation, marginalization, powerlessness, cultural imperialism, violence. All of these components of oppression at a systematic level comprise this kind of, you know, injustice. Now, when you look, for example, let's just talk about racism for a moment. When you look at the history of racism, and you look at the history of race itself, right? Part of what I argue in the paper is that speciesism and the view that humans have of animals is kind of what some philosophers call it's a fundamental aspect of these other oppressions. So, for example, if you think about animal subordination, the idea that there's this line, right? There's this line. It's a hard line. On one side of the line, morally are humans, and on the other side of the line are animals, and that's a strong moral line. Now, when you think about through the history of racism, what you see is questions, and this happens with all races, but all instances of racism, but it's clearly in the case of the human slave trade in the United States, we get the question of, are African Americans, are they human, right? Are they a full human? Are they closer to animals? If you look at the history of craniology, if you look at the history of race studies, this was an important question, at least to the races at the time, to figure out where exactly do the non-white races sit? Are they on the animal side or are they on the human side? Secondly, if you look at the history of the keeping of livestock, right? The notion that you have living beings that are treated like objects. This is where the notion of slavery and racism grew out of, this notion of breeding and having non-human livestock being possessions, being property. So the way that we systemically think about the relation between humans and animals and the superiority of humans to animals, that infrastructure, that mold, is the mold into which we fit things like other races and, mm-hmm. and racism. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if we think about sexism, if we think about the history of patriarchy, we think about the way women and animals and children were seen as property, the property of the male head of household. I mean, even the word animal husbandry, okay, we see it in the language. So these ideas that we have racism and sexism and speciesism tied together, these are what scholars like to call interlocking oppressions. And these are the kinds of things that when the light bulb goes on and you look and you see the bigger picture, then you can realize that this kind of systemic oppression applies across the species barrier. But not only that, that it's fundamental to the human-animal relation. And then from that, we apply it to the humans who we find less desirable, mm-hmm. and those we want to dominate and oppress.
Mm-hmm. Professor Jones, what struck me is it's almost, and tell me if I'm sort of following along. Philosophy has always been very difficult for me because I get caught up in I don't want to say circular logic. That's not what I mean at all. But as I was listening to you, it's what's interesting is that you're talking about, when we talk about racism and, you know, the racist that we're looking for a very clear distinction between African Americans and white Americans, or African descendants and European descendants. The white quote scientists or researchers were trying to figure out how they could morally justify bad behavior or behavior towards people with darker skin, because they're animals, they're not human, and therefore we can treat them in that way. And so the interesting part for me is that it's almost the intellect kicks in to find morality in bad behavior, and that's where my head starts to spin. Am I following you?
Well, yeah, I mean, so, yeah. One of the things that you're keying in on is that we have these practices, we have these institutions set up, and then when questions of their immorality are raised, then what we do is we search for a way to morally justify what we've already established, and we can back engineer all kinds of things, because we can say, look, here's a clear example. Thomas Jefferson, one of the, quote, founders of the country, right? He's a slave owner, and he writes a document, and he says all men are created equal under, you know, created equal by with a life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So he has this belief. He codifies it, and then there are these human beings who don't have these things that he says are universal and endowed by the Creator. So there's a couple of ways that you can go in this dilemma. One is you can say, oh, guess what? All human beings, including the African descendants, they're entitled to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Or you can say, oh, no, it's true. All men are created equal. They're not men, and now everything's fine, right? So you can see that when presented with this kind of cognitive dissonance, moral cognitive dissonance, people will tend to find, some kind of justification for the status quo. And what I'm trying to say, and what other philosophers who do animal rights are trying to say, is we need to shake up the status quo as it stands now with regard to speciesism, because what we're doing is, Sue, in the United States alone, just in the U.S., we're slaughtering 9 billion, that's with a B, 9 billion sentient animals for food unnecessarily every year. So that's a massive amount of sentient beings who are cognitively sophisticated, who feel pain and suffering, who are highly social creatures, pigs, cows, chickens, ducks, geese, things like that. So in the midst of our sort of blindness, the 9 billion animals in that particular situation, it's so ubiquitous that it's just invisible. It's an invisible aspect of our lives that I want to say to people, we need to wake up and see this massive kind of injustice. And if you believe in social justice, we will count under your umbrella of social justice these sentient beings who we are unnecessarily slaughtering.
Professor Jones, I always have a hard time recovering when I get an answer that is so thought-provoking. So let me sort of stutter through here. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to to Peace and Social Justice on KZFR Radio. We're talking with Professor Robert Jones, who teaches in the philosophy department at Chico State University. Professor Jones, boy, you really got me on that one. So you so beautifully just created that connection between, you know, having to incorporate, it's sort of an appreciation of all life in the context of the social justice movement. And what comes back to me is, if we can distinguish between humans, then, you know, and to justify slavery, and we've come to the point where we say there's no distinction between humans, the next step forward is to say there's no distinction between life, sentient beings. And one of the ways, if we could imagine that we get all the way, not all the way, but if we move that sort of the goalpost a little bit further away to say, okay, now we'll incorporate our domesticated dogs, and now we'll incorporate those kinds of things. I guess where the social justice issue comes in for me is, when we start, if we imagine to roll that goalpost back towards the human animals, at what point do we say back once again, those human animals are not deserving of social justice, but my human animal is, and my color and that kind of thing. I'm starting to talk in circles, which is why philosophy is hard for me. Professor Jones, let me kind of move us on a little bit further. You're giving us a talk. You're giving a talk tomorrow, and it's called Strategies Against Animal Research and Ranching. And I want to start with the research. You know, a lot of folks could argue that so much scientific progress has been the result of animal testing, and it's testing that you can't do on the human animal. So what do you say in response to folks that say, yeah, okay, that's a good idea, but let's get realistic day-to-day kind of stuff?
Well, first of all, I want to question the claim that animal researchers make is that without animal research, all these great advances wouldn't have been made, and so that's sort of their main claim, right? So I want to question that.
Okay.
First of all, the numbers of say lab animals who are experimented on every year, and most of them at this point are mice and rats, who are highly cognitive, sensitive, sentient beings. There are about 25 million a year that are basically killed in the labs. Now, a vast majority of those are not going to produce cures for diseases. The vast majority of those are doing what is called basic research, which is research to find out answers to questions. Animal researchers, here's the kind of view they take. Here's the way it works is, look, we don't really know. Science doesn't work in a linear way. It's not like you go from A to B, B to C, C to D, and you get a cure. The way it works is we sort of throw stuff against the wall, and whatever sticks, it works, and whatever doesn't stick, then we don't repeat that. So a lot of this animal experimentation is redundant, or it doesn't get anywhere. If you say to a scientist, well, this seems reasonable, right? I think for the average person, if you say, look, if you are going to experiment upon a sentient thing, it has to be something that's necessary. It can't be just for willy-nilly or just because you want to see what happens to a cat when it doesn't sleep for a month. It has to be, right? And scientists will say, well, that's not the way science works. We don't know exactly what's necessary. We just do a bunch of things. We have hypotheses. And then if something good comes from it, then that's what we get. And the researcher wants to say, don't hem me in at all. Let me have freedom to do this. I think that's the wrong attitude. I think the attitude is to say, these are really highly complex, sensitive, sentient beings, and to experiment on them or end their lives, to do that for some greater good requires just as much argument as it does to do it on human beings. So if you want to argue by sacrificing one human being, you may produce a cure for AIDS, that's a moral dilemma, but it's within the realm of you know, we can debate it.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, if you're going to experiment on sentient things, you better have the outcome better be clear, and the benefits better be really outweigh the suffering that has to be taking place.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, in a nutshell, that's where I'm coming from on that.
Professor Robert Jones, I want to take a quick pause here. I was supposed to wrap this interview up at this moment, but if you have a few more minutes, I do want to keep you on the air just a little bit longer. Do you have some time?
I do indeed, yes.
Okay, great. Then what I'd like to say is that this part of Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by the second annual NorCal Jazz Festival. Next is a free concert at 6 p.m. on Friday, April 17th, tonight, in the Chico City Plaza. On Sunday, the 19th, at 1 o'clock, it's the Sierra Nevada Big Room and the Delbert Bump B3 Trio, the Groove Diggers, Mood Swing, Dave Elke Trio, and more. Six acts, 5 hours of music. Visit NorCalJazzFestival.com for a full schedule of events and tickets. Tickets for the Big Room are also available at Chico Paper Company. The show is at 1 p.m., not 6 p.m., as stated on some of the tickets. The NorCal Jazz Festival is a project of Friends of the Arts. And this edition is made possible by Independent Living Services of Northern California, dedicated to gaining social and economic justice for people with disabilities. ILSNC can be reached by calling 893-8527. Or you can go to ILSNC.org. I do know for a fact that they have changed their name. They are now Disability Action Center. So this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We have Professor Robert Jones on the air with us from Binghamton, New York, although he's a professor here at Chico State University. He's with us for just a few more minutes, and then I have Council Member Randall Stone from the city of Chico to sit in for pretty much the full hour until 1 o'clock. But I want to mention that this next hour is made possible by the generous contributions of members and by EcoCab, Chico's green, clean and green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get to where you're going by calling EcoCab at 591-3186. EcoCab, the cab that cares. One more announcement. Peace and Social Justice is also made possible by iGreen, live in a bubble with clean air, comfort, and clean energy for your home. iGreen turns a house into a healthy environment by addressing the core components: heating and cooling, installation and repair, insulation, windows, daylighting, water heating, and solar energy to create a comfort and eliminate energy bills. iGreen finds the rebates and will file the paperwork. Tax credits and financing are also available. More information by calling iGreen at 230-0656, the Energy Efficiency Division of Green Construction Services. So thanks to all the folks and all the businesses that make this station continue and this show in particular possible. Professor Robert Jones, I do want to continue. I appreciate you giving me just a few more minutes.
Sure, my pleasure.
So let's go back to that, the presentation, the talk that you're going to give tomorrow, Strategies mm-hmm. Against Animal Research and Ranching. I want to ask you about ranching. What is the problem with ranching? I don't mean the environmental aspect. I'm talking about from your perspective of morality.
So, When I speak about ranching, for the most part, of those I mentioned to you, 9 billion sentient beings just in the United States alone, worldwide, the amount of animals killed for food is about 60 billion. That's with a B. So the population of the Earth is about 7 billion or so. About 8 times the population of the Earth every year on the planet are slaughtered for food of sentient beings. When it comes to ranching, I've had experience now. I've lived in Chico for almost 7 years, and I've interacted with a lot of ranching people. Here's my view is that it's, first of all, the consumption of animal products, the slaughter of animals for the consumption of animal products, is totally unnecessary. It's unnecessary. The American Dietetic Association has a position paper on vegan diets that say that vegan diets are nutritionally adequate, despite what people say about protein. They're healthful, and they actually provide health benefits in the prevention and treatment of certain diseases. So physiologically, it's just a fact that animal products are not necessary to flourish and thrive. That's one thing. So now we have these animals even on small ranches, things like dehorning, things like branding, castration, analgesia slaughter act, the federal act says that they must be stunned, but many times they're not stunned. They're slaughtered alive. There's absolutely no protection for poultry. Chicken can be slaughtered in any way without any kind of stunning or anything, and it's perfectly legal. So my central problem with raising animals for food is that it's basically unnecessary suffering caused, for the most part, because human beings, we enjoy the taste of meat. It's not a physiological necessity. Of course, it's a very complex issue. There are rich cultural traditions. Food is a rich cultural tradition. I'm not saying that tomorrow everyone needs to go vegan. What I am saying is that this industry, raising animals for food, it's obsolete. It's now that we can move forward, and as progressives, we can say, wait, we need to include non-human animals under the umbrella of social justice. To do that, and at the same time ignore the fact that we are slaughtering billions of animals for food, that's inconsistent. It's not satisfactory. So I think if we're really going to not have bad faith about this as people who are interested in social justice, we need to say, hey, I need to think about the way that my diet reflects my beliefs and my morals and my sort of my aspiring for social justice. So that's where I'm coming from there.
Yeah, Professor Robert Jones, you as I was reading this paper and kind of thinking through the ideas, that's exactly one of the things that came to me. You mentioned, there's a rich history, cultural, and even economic, which I know is the exploitation part of this conversation. But there's a long history of humans eating animals. And I was going to ask you about it, but you used the word obsolete. And so that's what's pretty interesting. You know, my first reaction, and I imagine the reaction of many listeners, is to say, yeah, but we've always done it, so isn't there some sort of biological component of humans eating meat or other animals eating other animals?
Sure.
But I do think that just because we used to do it, like slavery, doesn't mean we should always do it just because it's tradition, that kind of thing.
Right. I think that a lot of people, many people, when I have this conversation with them, they say to me, look, this is what human beings do. Human beings, as long as there have been human beings, there has been meat eating. And if you look in nature, like the lion eats the lamb. So this is the way the world is right now. I agree that that is the way the world is. But when we're talking about moral action and ethical principles, it's dangerous to look always to nature and say, well, nature tells us this is good. I mean, here's another claim. As long as there, as you referred to, Sue, as long as Homo sapiens have existed, there has been slavery. There's no record in history of any culture without slavery. As long as human beings have been in existence, there has existed rape. That's always been a part of human culture. Now, obviously, when we look at those two institutions, no one's going to make the argument, although people did 100 years ago,
right.
No one's going to make the argument, well, slavery, that's just natural. People are going to go, well, you know, human beings, we progress, we see the error of our ways. What I'm saying is the same thing applies to our treatment of non-human animals. Mm-hmm. Yes, we do eat animals, we have always eaten animals, and what I'm saying is, at this point, it's time for a shift. It's time for a massive paradigm shift to say, oh, these are complex sentient beings, and we do have these traditions, but do our traditions outweigh, do they trump the interests of these sentient beings? And my view is that they don't. They just do not.
Professor Robert Jones, this is so fascinating. And my sense is, don't let him go. On the other hand, you're training to become a programmer here at KZFR, and you have a program in mind that addresses this very issue that non-human animals must be part of the vision for social justice. If we're to move forward in the quest for social justice, Professor Jones, talk about what you have in mind for this program.
Well, that's thanks for asking that question. I feel like I can put a plug in for the program that I don't even have yet. But I am in training, along with my friend and colleague and animal rights vegan superstar, Jeannie Trezino, here in Chico. We are putting together a little radio program. And now, for years, KZFR had Sarah Down's program, Animal Matters and Sentience, and that went off the air. And so there's kind of a vacuum, and we think the community could really be benefited by having a show. So we're planning a 30-minute program, and we don't quite have a name for it yet, something like non-human radio or something. We haven't figured that out. But part of what we want to do on the show is we want to have a weekly program where we talk about animal rights, maybe news and local or national things. We can have a little book review. And, you know, we're going to talk with local and national animal rights activists, have a little call-in with the listeners. Jeannie is really up on vegan restaurants and recipes. We'll talk about that. And then we'll have, you know, some sort of thoughts for the week about what's happening on the calendar. So, you know, we want to keep this alive. You know, I mean, Chico is an interesting community. We have, you know, there's a whole community of people who raise animals for a living, and then there's a whole other community too, and not that they don't overlap, but there's a community of people who are interested in social justice, and trying to bridge those two communities, I think there's a lot of sort of a rich palette that we can use in Chico to bring these people together and talk about these issues. And if I could, Sue, one more thing, if you would allow me, we also have the Chico Animal Rights reading group, which we meet the second Tuesday of every month over at Woodstock Pizza. They offer vegan pizza there, and it's very delicious. Second Tuesday of every month at 7 p.m., we meet at Woodstock Pizza, and we discuss a short little article on animal rights or vegetarianism or something, and it's really a lot of fun, and we have people there who are not vegetarian, who are not animal rights people, and the idea is to bring people in the community together to discuss this. So if people are interested in that, you can go to the Chico Peace and Justice Center website and search for the CARES, C-A-R-E-S. That's our group, Animal Rights and Education Speaker Series. So those are some of the things that we have in store for the community with regard to animal rights between the Justice Center and also KZFR.
Right. Professor Robert Jones, thanks so much. I know you're busy out there doing conferences and talks and things like that. I really appreciate your time. It's been very thought-provoking, very interesting.
Okay, Sue, thanks a lot.
All righty. You have a good
bye-bye.
One. Bye-bye.
You too, bye.
All right, we're going to take a very, very quick break. When we come back, I have City Council Member Randall Stone in the studio. We're going to talk about the latest contracts.